Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today we have an amazing Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Our first guest is historian Thaddeus Russell, and we have a very special guest coming on after Thaddeus, Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Cleveland, Ohio. Our first guest, Thaddeus Russell, is a historian and cultural critic and the author of A Renegade History of the United States. Thaddeus has published scholarly essays in American Quarterly and the Columbia History of Post-World War II America. Russell has appeared on the History Channel, Al Jazeera, Fox News, and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He teaches American history and cultural studies at Occidental College and has taught history, American studies, and the history of philosophy at Columbia University, Barnard College, the New School for Social Research, and Eugene Lane College. Born and raised in Berkeley, California, Russell graduated from Antioch College and received a PhD in history from Columbia University. And today we have him on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Thad, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you on. And I don't know, you probably don't know this, but I studied U.S. history at UCLA, so I've been finding your perspective very refreshing.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And there's just so much to focus on. But the first question I want to ask you is, how is your book, A Renegade's History of the United States, how is that different from, say, the late Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States?
Right. Well, so, I mean, I, like a lot of people, read Howard Zinn's book cover to cover when I first got serious about history. In fact, when I first went to graduate school at Columbia, I picked it up on purpose and read every single word of it, and it was very inspiring for me. What I found later on, when I was in graduate school and got further into it, there was a level of it that was dissatisfying for me, which was that it felt as if he was looking, he stopped his gaze at sort of the leaders, essentially, of the people, rather than the people themselves, mm-hmm. in many cases. And, you know, I was born and raised in a socialist, labor activist, civil rights, feminist family, so I was very comfortable with that, and those are the people who originally inspired me. But I always wondered, you know, how did they differ from their constituents, the people they spoke for and on behalf of? And sort of just in living in America and contemporary society and looking around, it always struck me that, you know, most people weren't earnest, socially minded do-gooders. And I wondered about what that whole stratum of society might have been doing in history and what they might have actually contributed to our culture. And so that's really the product. That's the product of that query is in Renegade History of the United States. And I found that what a lot of so-called unseemly or immoral or degraded people were doing actually became really part of our mainstream freedoms and pleasures that we all enjoy and come to expect. And then what was really sort of a major life-changing revelation for me was to find that unfortunately, a lot of the leaders of the great social movements of American history were actually really hostile to a lot of those freedoms, things they called renegade freedoms, in the past. And that when I got right down to it, I realized that they really essentially shared a lot of what we call bourgeois values with mm-hmm. the ruling class. They're really essentially puritanical, Victorian, bourgeois, 19th century style thinkers. And were very critical of their own constituents. And this goes back to the abolitionists and early suffragists and civil rights leaders and labor leaders. They all really upheld the Puritan work ethic stringently and upheld a very puritanical view of sexuality in particular and told their people to behave and to be like the good American citizen that the founding fathers had created. So I felt like they were really conservative in a deep cultural, psychological way. It was dissatisfying for me. So I moved beyond that and tried to look at those who broke the rules and even the rules of the social movement leaders. So that's the renegade history of the United States. That's how it's different from Zinn's book.
Well, you mentioned that some of the leaders were very conservative, and one piece I read from your book that was posted on the Daily Beast was talking about Martin Luther King Jr., for example, and many people have been, you know, telling us that Barack Obama is the fulfillment of King's legacy, you know, in the civil rights way, in the peace way. I've been battling that assumption between Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama, but you have a different perspective on that and how actually, in some ways, Obama has been following in Martin Luther King Jr.'s footsteps.
Yeah, I mean, on King, I'm ambivalent. You know, I think that, you know this as well as anyone, but like on terms of peace and war, King actually came to that position, that great position on Vietnam, fairly late in the game, actually. He gets a lot of credit for it, but he was not, at the very beginning, opposed to the war. But he ended up with exactly, from my position, the right perspective on it. Obama, from the beginning, and I know you've written about this, but said this, Obama, from the beginning, has been an imperialist, you know, a liberal of the Wilsonian variety, and this is why I have opposed him from day one. They're not an exact match on that issue, but on cultural issues, they are pretty much an exact match. So King issued a number of very stern sermons in black churches across the South at the height of the civil rights movement. He wrote a weekly column for Ebony Magazine, which could have been written by Pat Robertson. Mm-hmm. It was really about personal issues, personal values, the way to live. He attacked all forms of non-marital sexuality. He attacked rock and roll, which, of course, was a black creation. He attacked it as a product of the devil, really. He said black people should stop drinking and gambling. He said that even if you swept streets for a living, you should embrace that work as God's creation, which is really, you know, a pure expression of the Puritan work ethic. These are deeply conservative values that actually, what's interesting is in the last 5 to 6 years, a lot of conservatives, true conservatives now, have found that in his work and have been trumpeting him, and I think correctly, as really a carrier of those very deeply held conservative values from the 18th and 19th centuries. So during the campaign for presidency in 2008, you know, I was not actually surprised to see Obama do very much the same thing. He was in some ways a little more vicious, actually, than King was in his attacks on black culture. And I understood that it was also partly a political calculation. But he, you know, he said these really, if a white person had said them, if McCain had said them, he would have been blown out of the race as a racist. There's no question about it. But, you know, Obama got up in black churches and said, stop feeding your children fried chicken.
Wow.
He talked about Popeye's chicken. And put down the remote and stop watching ESPN. Get off the couch. And he talked about, used these sort of stereotypical black nicknames, Pookie and Jethro. Said, you know, get Pookie and Jethro off the couch. Tell them to get out and vote and work hard and raise their children right. And, he, you know, he issued it on Father's Day.
Right.
He had this really fire and brimstone sermon, basically, against black men in general, who he said were not, who he called children. He said they had not grown up to full men. He said, even though they have whiskers on their chins, we have a lot of brothers in our community who are not, we're not full men. And, you know, it was, to me, as soon as I heard him hear that, I said, oh, that, he got that from King. And not just King, but almost all the major civil rights leaders shared those values and said very similar things. A. Philip Randolph hated jazz, attacked jazz relentlessly, and said black people should only play classical music. Same with W.E.B. Du Bois. So it's a deep tradition, unfortunately, in basically black African-American political leadership, and Obama's, certainly that's part of his legacy.
How do you explain the support for Obama from that community?
Well, I mean, African Americans have always been split on this. It's not as if, this all goes all the way back really to abolition. Frederick Douglass began this. He said, if we're going to rise out of slavery and gain full citizenship during Reconstruction, we're going to have to behave, think exactly like white people do. And so he was very much a proponent of what the Reconstruction schools did, which was teach the freed, newly freed slaves to essentially be Puritans. You know, they told them, you know, work all the time, believe that work in itself is a virtue, a godly virtue, no matter what you get for it. You know, get married as soon as you can and stay with one person the rest of your life. Work all day long. As soon as you are done with work, come straight home and spend the rest of the evening with your family. Don't drink. Don't gamble. It was really an anti-pleasure, very aesthetic aesthetic set of values. And so, but that became very much a part of Black political and religious leadership rhetoric right after the Civil War, and it's been there ever since. And so some of the major opponents, say, of hip-hop have been Black leaders like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, mm-hmm. who have waged, you know, these boycott campaigns, and they've marched in front of record studios, et cetera. Jesse Jackson called for a boycott of disco. Many people don't know this, in the 1970s. But at the same time, you know, many African-Americans, like many people in general, have gone their own way in many ways and really pursued individual freedoms and individual desires against those demands by the leadership. And so there's always been this sort of cultural civil war among African-Americans, just like among everyone else. But among African-Americans, it's been in some ways more intense. So it's a hard thing to explain, but you know, when Obama did that, people, I think, either ignored him or they agreed with him. I mean, when he spoke these things, he did these in Black churches during the campaign, and
right.
he was given, you know, huge rounds of applause, and it made sense to me because these are, you know, these are Black Baptists, these are Black Methodists, these are Black political leaders. It's that class of African Americans who have been saying that for 150 years.
Well, what's your perspective along these same lines with the same questions about how people like, you know, perhaps like Malcolm X or the Black Panthers were, you know, involved in this renegade's history?
Yeah, I mean, there's another huge disappointment for me. I mean, I, you know, grew up, when I became political, I really admired Malcolm X greatly. And I still do, and I do think that the Black nationalist tradition is a very valuable one, in that it establishes a separation from the power establishment, from the establishment for African Americans, and always has, and I have, and I always think that that's a good thing to have. So simply an option, rather than full integration, there was that option that they presented. On the other hand, if you start with the early Black nationalists, even in the 19th century, but especially with Garvey, Marcus Garvey in the 1920s,
mm-hmm.
And then through the Nation of Islam in the 50s, 60s, 70s, the values that they uphold actually are really stringently puritanical. And if you think about, you know, what the Nation of Islam man looked like, he's wearing a suit and tie and a bow tie. And Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad were, and even Farrakhan, have always been very, very clear and upfront about this. You know, we must uphold the values for them of Islam, but really they mirror those of Christianity and of the founding fathers and of 19th century bourgeois moralists.
Mm-hmm.
And so Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad were really militant against what I would call African American culture. And so they, you know, they hated jazz, they hated rock, they hated rhythm and blues. They hated the West African and American slave attitude toward work, which was much different than the white European attitude, which is that you do work when you have to do it, when it's necessary, not because it's a virtue in itself. You know, and that, to me, that's my greatest inspiration, is that view of work as only a necessary evil and nothing more than that. But the Black nationalists, unfortunately, partly because they knew to create their own nation required a lot of work, they said from the beginning, you know, we have to do what the Europeans did, just with black faces and in a different part of the world. But it's actually quite depressing, or was depressing when I started reading that stuff, beginning with Garvey and all the way through Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad. You know, they said can't do drugs. We got to stop drinking. We got to work hard. We've got to, you know, be good fathers and good husbands, and that's it. And really, so there's no real difference culturally between them and what white European and American Christians have been saying for centuries.
Well, what about the Black Panther movement?
Panthers are a different, I mean, they're a mix. I mean, they said a lot of that. You know, Huey Newton did issue a very famous proclamation welcoming gays and lesbians into the movement, which is,
mm-hmm.
you know, homosexuality, by the way, was always attacked really viciously by both civil rights and black nationalist leaders. And Huey was the first one to break from that. Although, if you read that document, too, even there, it's more of a political tactic. At least I read it that way. I'm not sure. And there's quite a bit of evidence that Huey Newton was himself at least bisexual. But, the Panthers, again, sort of culturally, you know, sort of, nationalism, right? I mean, nationalism itself is, by necessity, a very harsh, demanding, austere, self-sacrificing doctrine, regardless of who's speaking it. And it also ends up becoming quite violent and warlike. You know, so there's, to me, there's a real dark side to nationalism, no matter who's speaking it. And a lot of it is sort of an attack on personal freedom that is required to establish a nation. But going that route of choosing nationalism or choosing integration into another nation, like the white nation, all those leaders understood that it required this austere attack on individual freedom and pleasure, unfortunately.
Well, with all of this background that we've just had, what is your perspective on Obama's attack on a North African country of Libya? What is that? What is your perspective? What do you think about that?
Well, at the beginning of the campaign, I remember when he was in favor of bolstering AFRICOM, the African Central Command, the military command. You know, and that was just one piece of his imperialist agenda. But when he did that, I thought, okay, this is it. I mean, how can anyone on the left at this point say anything other than he's going to end up killing more brown-skinned people than Bush did? And what I predicted from 2007, when I first heard about this guy, first read his plans and his politics, and I think he's well on his way to doing it. I'm quite sure he's the perfect vehicle to kill lots of brown-skinned people. And he's doing it, unfortunately, as almost better than I predicted. So the attack on Libya, right? I mean, I just saw this piece in Yahoo News today, which you may have seen or not, but which I knew what was going on, but now there's evidence. Some senior administration official was saying, we basically trumped up the charges of war crimes in order to reestablish the principle or the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, you know, the Clintonian humanitarian intervention doctrine, which I knew exactly. They've been waiting to do this since they took office because of people that he brought in, essentially neocons and then people like Samantha Power and Susan Rice, who have been saying this for years and years and years, who want more, you know, American military intervention in the world. But for them, it's, of course, this old liberal Wilsonian mission of saving the unfortunates in the world, you know. And so there's this confluence going on of the neocon and the liberal imperialist missions of remaking the world in our own image. And Obama is the absolute perfect vehicle for it. And what I've just been, since he announced and since the left began embracing him, I have felt like I've been on an island. And I've been yelling for 3 years now.
Uh-huh.
This guy, his politics essentially is, especially on foreign policy. You know, on foreign policy, it's just been completely clear-cut. There's no doubt about it. Are essentially, if anything, worse than the neoconservative agenda. His mission is global. And when he gave the Nobel War, I call it the Nobel War Prize speech, you know, he made that really clear. He said in that speech, and a lot of people miss this, he said, where we see in the world people not adhering to our beliefs, we reserve the right to intervene militarily. That is what he said in that speech. I mean, it was an astonishing moment to me. But most astonishing was that a lot of the left missed that. And meanwhile, of course, neoconservatives like Kagan and Max Booth are now completely on board, have been on board even since the election, especially in foreign policy. Max Booth is a big fan of what he's doing in Libya and, of course, in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think it's, you know, Glenn Ford at the Black Agenda Report has been saying this from the beginning. It is an absolute, total collapse of anything that we would call a liberatory anti-war left. It is an absolute catastrophe in our political culture, and that's what he's represented for me and for a handful of people since the beginning.
Well, like me, I mean, I'm with you. I've been, I've been against him because I actually read about him and listened to what he said from the beginning, but I've been very outspoken against the U.S. intervention. And intervention is a very sweet word for using hundreds of Tomahawk missiles on innocent people. But what gets me is the attacks that I've been, having to go through from people who say that they're anti-war, and then they slam me because they say I don't care about the Libyan people. Because I'm against the U.S. Bombing them to save them, I guess. And so you're right. Obama gives the imperialists, the, you know, the globalists, whatever, perfect cover to essentially take over the world.
Yeah, the, you know, the anti-war movement completely evaporated, you know. I mean, save for you and a handful of other, a very small handful of other people.
Right.
Completely evaporated with his election. I mean, during Bush, it wasn't exactly vigorous, but there were, you know, I was, when I went to demonstrations during Bush, you know, there were tens of thousands of people in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it had been even more, you know, aggressive, but we're, there were, we had large numbers. Now it's what? It's 10 people on a street corner, you know,
right.
The sign. And what's going on? The guy's actually now waging three wars instead of two. He's increased the military. He's increased the number of troops. He's increased the military budget. It's just, it's Bush, but worse. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. This guy we hated as the Satan, you know, the guy who's now doing, actually enlarging his imperialist policies, we're giving him a pass. Or worse, we've merged our identities with him. We are now him, you know? I mean, we put his face on our cars and our houses and our
mm-hmm.
children's bodies and T-shirts, you know? And the next time I see an Obama sticker and a peace sticker on the same car, I think I will have to get out and approach that person.
I
mean, it makes me feel it's almost Orwellian. It really is. You know, the
what about the Obama stickers with the O as a peace sign?
With the O as a peace sign.
Yeah,
right? I mean,
that, I know. That makes me want to vomit.
It's time to start confronting those people. I mean, a lot of them are not politically savvy, obviously, but a lot of them are, and that's the problem. I don't blame, you know, the 18-year-old college kids who got turned on by him. I can understand that they didn't know better. I'm talking about the liberal and left intellectual establishment. People have been doing and talking and studying politics for their entire lives who still, I mean, there's some erosion of that, but still many of them are saying, give them a pass, or they're simply not, they're not angry. They're not angry the way they were with Bush. You don't say things like, not in my name, when you kill people, the way they did with Bush.
Right.
They're not distancing themselves. That's the problem. They're not distancing themselves psychologically, personally. They continue to identify with this guy, and that is the problem. You must separate from power, in particular a militaristic imperial power like this one. You must separate yourself psychologically, and that's what the left used to do. Even when it was good liberal Democrats like Johnson and Kennedy, they still separated themselves when they started killing people en masse. Why is that not happening now? And I understand that racial politics has a whole lot to do with this, but that's what the left has to confront, and the anti-war movement in particular must do that, or else the game is over. The game is over. I see no opposition except for a tiny handful of us among,
right.
on the left, anti-war left, and among libertarians, by the way, who have mm-hmm. been excellent on this point from the beginning. That's it, you know. But it's not the masses. There is no movement because of that, because we merged our identities with this guy who's a murderer, a mass murderer.
Well, Thad, it's been wonderful talking to you because, like you, I felt like I'm on an island all week or living in some kind of bizarro world where the right should be dancing in the streets and supporting Obama and realizing that he's one of them, and the left should be doing the opposite. But it seems like we live in some kind of bizarro world where everything's been turned upside down. And during the Bush administration, I was called an anti-Semite when I opposed his policies. Now I'm called a racist. So the
right.
empire is very good at, you know, their propaganda, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're very clever. Obviously, they picked the right guy.
Thaddeus Russell, author of Renegade History of the United States, I hope you come back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It's been really good talking to you.
I'd love to, Cindy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That was our guest, Thaddeus Russell. And now our very special guest is Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Cleveland, Ohio. And we will talk about the U.S.-UN intervention in Libya. Congressman Kucinich, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It's such an honor to have you on.
Thanks, Cindy. It's good to talk to you again.
Well, I was driving yesterday, and I was flipping through the channels, and I heard your voice. And it happened to be on Sean Hannity's show, and I heard you talking to Sean about this U.S.-UN intervention in Libya, and I wanted you to have you on to tell my listeners your concerns about it.
Yes, and I appreciate a chance to do that. I can tell you just immediately that there are so many problems with this intervention, the first being that the president did not come to Congress, the second being that it's quite likely to strengthen Colonel Gaddafi's hand and to cause even more havoc to be wreaked against the people of Libya. And third, the United States now is in its third war. This war will cost us at least $1 billion, according to some reports we saw today. Our military is stretched thin. This is a new nightmare for the people of another land and a new nightmare for the American people.
And I heard you also talking to Hannity about how it's an internal question. It's a problem of Libyans. Now, I have been thoroughly attacked by people who would have been on my side when Bush was president, but who aren't now, saying that I must not care about the people of Libya if I don't want the U.S. to intervene humanitarily. What's your answer to that?
Well, humanitarian war is an oxymoron.
Right.
Because the minute that you begin an attack, the next thing you hear is collateral damage, which is a euphemism for killing innocent people. We noted in the attack on George Bush noted when he directed the U.S. troops to attack Iraq with congressional approval, I might add, that Saddam Hussein was killing his own people.
Mm-hmm.
Then we proceeded using our extraordinary military might to engage in an attack that has resulted, according to Joseph Stiglitz and his Linda Bilmes in their book called The $3 Trillion War, mm-hmm. in the deaths of perhaps as many as 1 million people, where they extrapolated the Lancet report to a present day. So we have to understand that interventions never end up the way you think they will, and that innocent people will get killed. And the decision to intervene is a dangerous decision. It's not just we should be applaud ourselves for our humanitarian instincts. We all care. The mm-hmm. question is, will you do more harm than good? That's the question that wasn't answered, because there was a decision made to go to war without having to have a debate in Congress about it.
Well, tell us about the letter that Congress people got from President Obama on Monday.
The president justified his call for war by claiming the second article of the Constitution gives him the right to do what he did. He talked about the humanitarian crisis there, but he talked about his remedy deriving from what his reading was of the Constitution. But frankly, his reading of the Constitution in March of 2011 is at sharp variance to his reading of the Constitution in December of 2007 when he told the Boston Globe, and I quote, "The president does not have the power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not involve stopping an actual or imminent threat to the nation." So this is Barack Obama speaking to the Boston
right.
Globe in 2007 on December 20th. So we really have to be concerned about an overreach, about an executive abuse of power here. And this has nothing to do with the personality of the president. It has everything to do with the consequences of a war and why Congress has to be consulted. Maybe Congress would approve, but you know what? If Congress approves, at least the American people have some direct political recourse to those making the decisions.
Well, also, many people during the Bush administration felt that Congress abrogated its role, you know, giving authorization to use military force, and that Bush overreached that authorization to use military force, and that wasn't really the constitutional way to do it either. The constitutional way would be for Congress to debate and then declare war.
Well, we had a couple things happen. First of all, after 9/11, Congress voted to give the president the ability to use force. He did not use that, by the way, to go into Iraq. He asked
right.
for a separate declaration.
Right.
And the, however, the global war on terror was given, was seen by George Bush as a license to wage war anywhere at any time. This president is claiming the ability to take our country into a war based on, one, humanitarian conditions in Libya, and two, on his authority under Article 2, which doesn't say anything about a president having the right to send armed forces into a war. The Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is the only express place in the Constitution where they mention the war powers, and that's very firmly put in the hands of Congress. And for those who think this is an academic debate, let me tell you, the founders felt very strongly about putting the war power in the hands of the legislative bodies, because and it's very easy to understand. I mean, if you look at the Declaration of Independence and all of the charges that were levied against George III, almost in the form of an indictment, you understand that they weren't looking at creating an executive with far-reaching authorities. If Article II represents anything, it's the limitations of executive power, but that's changed greatly in interpretations of presidential power over the last few generations.
Well, Congressman Kucinich, where is President Obama getting the money for this so-called intervention, humanitarian intervention in Libya?
Well, this money is going to come from U.S. taxpayers. It will come from changing our priorities. It will come from, my guess, at some point, another appropriation by the Congress. It'll come from a deepening deficit. I mean, this is, this is the consequence. And when this decision is made to go to war without Congress being involved, then to come back to Congress and say, "Well, pay for it," is not the way the Constitution is supposed to work. Now, it may be that when we try to block funding for the wars, that more Congress members will favor funding, and then if we have a vote, that at least enables Congress to be heard from. Then it becomes a political argument about who took what position.
Right. Tell us about your resolution. I think you co-sponsored it with Congressman Ron Paul from Texas about ending the occupation of Afghanistan by, I think it was the end of this year.
Right. Well, we did have a vote a week ago in the House of Representatives on a resolution that myself, Congressman Walter Jones, and Ron Paul and others co-sponsored. The final vote on that bill was 321 against getting out of Afghanistan by the end of the year and 93 in favor. We gained about 26 votes from the previous vote. The last time we had 65 yes votes, and this time we had 93, so 28. We had 28 more votes this time to get out of Afghanistan. So I think we're moving in the right direction. Obviously, there's not enough members of Congress who are engaged in this issue. We're in a decade of war in Afghanistan, 8 years of war in Iraq. We're going to ruin our country if we don't start to pull back from this never-ending war, interventionism, militarism.
Well, I have a lot of respect for you, and when I heard that interview yesterday, my respect is like skyrocketed for you to go on Fox News and talk about things like this. But what I was dismayed about was that Sean Hannity agreed with you on a lot of things, and if there's any like accountability for this president about not coming to Congress, it's going to appear to be something that's purely political, because the Republicans have control of the House now, and you are courageously stepping up there to kind of put a nonpartisan face on this criticism.
Well, I look at things here without regard to party, and the minute that you start to see things only through a partisan lens, you lose your ability to be able to serve all the people. And so I'm going to continue doing everything I can to stand for peace, to stand for the end of war, to start to take care of things here at home and rebuild America, create the jobs that will help make that happen, make sure our children have the education they deserve, help people get the health care that they need, and to protect retirement security. And, you know, we still have the capacity to be able to have a better country, but we're letting it slip away the more that these wars intrude into our national experience, and the more that we sanction interventionism.
Right. Well, you're one of our only voices in Congress, you know, people who feel the same way that we do. And you, your district in Ohio has been eliminated. So what can my listeners do to help support you?
Well, I think we have to wait on that one, because I'm it is true that my district is slated to be eliminated. I intend to stay in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know where I'll be running. So that's really a decision that I can't make just yet. But sometime this year, we should have a further discussion.
And what about giving President Obama a primary challenge?
Well, I think it'd be a good idea for somebody to do that, but I don't have any plans to do that, Cindy.
Well, thank you, Congressman Kucinich, for being on the show and for being such a friend of peace, and we really appreciate you.
Thank you for who you are. Thanks, Cindy.
And I hope to talk to you again soon.
We'll do it.
That was our friend Dennis Kucinich, and I hope that we find out ways that we can help support him, help support his voice. I know there's some controversy about Dennis Kucinich, but I know him personally. I've had breakfast with him in his home in Cleveland, Ohio, and I do think that overall he is a man of integrity, and he will stand up for what he believes in.
Please come to Chicago just to sing. In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world.
the Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I hope you enjoyed the show. I know I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I hope you come back and listen next week. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, you for listening, and my guests, Thaddeus Russell and Congressman Dennis Kucinich. And a lot of people have contacted me about what song we used to close the show with last week. That was called Ball and Biscuit by the White Stripes, and we played that song at the end of the show last week. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. Sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.